a Thursday edition. Thanks very much for tuning in. My name is Steve Bertrand. A little bit later, we will talk to Bridget Carey from CNET. I mentioned with Bill and Wendy about Teddy Ruxpin making a comeback. I don't quite get that, but that's a story that Bridget wrote, so we'll ask her about that. Also, they have an article in CNET about the facial recognition aspect of the new iPhone and how that is more susceptible to police intervention. I'm not sure the right word, but the police would need less of a search warrant to have you access your phone with facial recognition than they would with, say, a four-digit passcode. Bridget will sort that out for us a little bit later. So if you're up to no good, you might want to not want to rely just on your face. We'll talk about that. And the half marathon in Chicago is coming up this weekend. We'll talk about the marketing of that. But, you know, we talk a lot about startups on this program, and whether it's a local business, a restaurant, a suitcase that you can ride on, all of that. That's one thing. But what about a business that might save 500,000 babies a year? That is the goal of the Rice 360 Institute for Global Health. They're up for a $100 million MacArthur Foundation grant. And one of the key people on that team is Kara Palamountain. She's a research associate professor at the Kellogg School of Management. She joins us now on a phone line. Kara, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Thank you. We're so excited to be on your program today. Thank you for having us.
Well, I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're there. I love the work that you're doing. When do you find out if you are the recipient of this grant?
So this week on Tuesday, we found out that we were one of four finalists competing in the MacArthur Foundation's $100 million competition. And we find out on December 11th after we present to the MacArthur Foundation's board.
All right. So the statistic I started the show with was that 1.1 million babies die in Africa every year, babies who might have been easily saved had they had access to equipment that have been in hospitals here in the U.S. and in most of the developed world over the past 50 years. Your goal is to get that equipment, the equipment from here to there, correct?
That's correct. I think one important thing to think about is why aren't these technologies there today? And while a lot of these technologies exist, they're very simple technologies. They help babies breathe. They help them reduce infection. They help with support their organs that may not be fully formed if they're preterm. But why aren't they available in Africa? And our team is called the Newborn Essential Solution and Technologies, or NEST, and we're focused on the principal reasons and the principal barriers that we see for making those technologies accessible in Africa.
Okay, those of us who know very little about Africa, but who think we probably do, say, oh, it's just a terribly impoverished country, and that would never work there. That's an oversimplification part of it, but a lot of it just has to do with infrastructure, right? The construction of the hospitals.
Yeah, so Africa is 54 countries, and 1.1 million babies die every year, as you mentioned. And these statistics are horrifying and heartbreaking. Our team has witnessed many of these deaths. We've seen the impact that these deaths have on families, and we know the feeling of helplessness that healthcare workers have when they could have saved lives if they'd had access to some of the tools that they learned about in medical school. The barriers that we see are that the equipment really isn't designed for these settings. As you mentioned, the harsh environments can be quite challenging, either access to electricity or the humid and hot environments. Also, the business functions required to make these technologies widely accessible, it's not well coordinated. And then finally, The ability to train and maintain the equipment is another area that our group is focused on.
That's interesting to me. So you don't just need the machinery. What you need is the sort of the human infrastructure to grow people into handling it, not just now, but the next generation as well.
Yeah, so what's interesting is that a lot of the nurses and the clinicians that are delivering babies and taking care of them shortly after they're born, they've been taught how to use a lot of these technologies and their syllabi and they look very similar to what you might see here in the U.S. The challenge is that when you go into these environments, the equipment is actually broken down oftentimes because it wasn't designed for those environments.
And so what do you do then? Do you, because and correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seemed as if part of your plan was to create sort of an economic infrastructure where businesses would want to come in, facilitate those machines, sell those machines, but Then looking a little more closely, you realize that you might have to set up a not-for-profit to get that going off the ground.
Sure. So our project has three pillars, and the first one is innovation, the second is access, and the third is sustainability. So with regards to innovation, all the products in our Nest bundle have to have four qualities. They have to be affordable, rugged, easy to use, and effective. And there are actually a number of technologies that are already developed and designed to meet these criteria. And what we'll do with our project is test these out in the country of Malawi and roll them out across the entire country,
you know,
to
Kara,
make sure that they are affordable.
We're talking about machinery or equipment, but are these things that I would understand? Are we talking about incubators, or what are we talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Incubator, keeping babies warm, helping them breathe, so CPAP machines, phototherapy lights for infants with jaundice, and also some basic infection tools to help manage infections.
So very basic stuff.
Yes.
And
things that have been available in the U.S. for about 50 years now.
And you're saying that you could save 500,000 babies a year at, you estimate, a cost of $1.48 per birth.
That's right. So we estimate an entire package of Nest technologies would cost on the around $26,000, which would be optimized for a hospital that delivers about 5,000 babies a year. So if you think about the life of these technologies, had they, you know, if they're designed for these environments, that translates to around $1.48 per birth, which is very cost effective as compared to some other interventions.
I mean, it's just incredible that for $1.48 that it's something that this could change, that people could be saved. But it's interesting to me that it's not just about money in many ways. I mean, it's about clearly money to create infrastructure or to do things like that, but it's not just a matter of writing a check and getting it done.
That's right. I mean, I think one of the things we're also focused on is the benefits and quantifying the benefits that a hospital or a health system can receive from making this investment. So one of the things we'll be doing is rolling out this technology in a group of hospitals in Tanzania and measuring what the reduction in deaths is. And that will give hospital and policymakers a much better decision, a much better case for making their investment.
Kara Palamountain is a research associate professor at the Kellogg School of Management and a lecturer of global health. Okay, Kara, I'm in a tough fix here because I don't really want to root against the other three finalists. I'm sure they're doing great things too.
Absolutely. All are game changers. And we're so impressed by not only these finalists, but also the semifinalists. There's a lot of impressive proposals out there.
Wouldn't it be great if they could all win? Good luck to you. I look forward to finding out in December.
Thank you so much.
A little bit later in the program, we're going to talk about the Chicago Half Marathon coming up in Chicago this weekend. I think it's on Sunday. And, you know, we're trying to get Amazon here, or many people are. I guess Tom Gimbel isn't. We'll talk to him tomorrow. But just wonder if events like that bring new eyes and new legs into the city and might help long term. We'll talk to the brand manager of the Chicago Half Marathon. But right now, Bill Geiger is in the studio of Geiger Wealth Management. Our regular conversations with Bill are sponsored by Geiger Wealth Management. Mr. Geiger, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
Good to be here, sir.
Okay, let's start. First things first. Last time you were here, Irma was taking site on Florida, and we were talking about you have property down there.
I have a home just outside of Boca Raton. And we ended up losing two bushes and a small tree I never liked anyhow.
Well, that's good to hear. So everything is fine there.
Everything's fine.
How about your
you.
Buddy who was batting down the hatches? I guess he would have been okay.
He batted them down. Everything's good there, too.
Oh, good. Okay. So it didn't even knock any sense into him. Or maybe he had
it from the start. No.
You know, millennials more so than us, but I think people now of my generation as well are moved from job to job. And
baby boomers are too.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I'm unusual in that I haven't moved that much.
Yeah, baby boomers have too. And one of the things that happens is every time you get a new job, by definition, you have an old 401k, right?
Right, right. So you think about the new things you're going into, the new benefits or the new insurance and all of that, and sometimes forget about what you've left behind.
And we call those orphan 401ks.
Okay, so what about just leaving those orphan 401ks out there and letting them grow and kind of forgetting about them?
Well, nothing is good to just forget about, right?
Right, I suppose.
And there's unique opportunity with those old 401ks. Even if you're not old enough to move the money, once you move from an old company to a new company, you can take your old 401k plan and roll it into an IRA. Steve, and that is extremely powerful because you have a lot more options that you can do in there. Let me give you an example. People don't have pension plans anymore.
Right.
Right? But you can take an old 401k plan. What if you could turn that into a pension plan for yourself? We had a 55-year-old couple come in the office a couple weeks ago, had an old 401k plan, $400,000 in it. They're going to retire in 10 years.
Okay.
We took that $400,000, we put it into an income strategy. When they're ready to retire, they're going to have a $45,000 lifetime income, effectively a private pension plan for themselves. And isn't that something better than just forgetting
about it? Forgetting about it? I suppose forgetting is never a good idea.
You do some powerful stuff. It's amazing.
And so you can continue to contribute to your new 401k.
Absolutely.
But take advantage of your old 401k.
Sure. And take that old 401k plan and do something with it that's really powerful. I mean, the most powerful thing that we can have in retirement is just a whole bunch of income. When people have a lot of income, they have a big pension plan, they sleep well at night, and they know how they're going to pay their bills. Well, if you could take that old 401k plan and convert it into basically a pension right. for yourself, how powerful is that?
How do you do that?
Well, there's some tools we use, some different and as a matter of fact, Steve, that $45,000 income stream for life, they put in $400,000. By the time they're 85, they still have about $600,000 left, even though they've pulled out about $1 million worth of income. Yeah. So it's an extremely powerful income generating strategy. It's a little bit longer to explain than on the air here, but it works really, really well.
Do you think most people understand that? Because I don't think that's something I would have thought of.
No. No, they don't. It's one of the reasons we feel so extremely strong about client education. People go about running their financial lives by the latest Yahoo story they right. saw on the internet. And if you're in your late 50s to early 60s, you can do better. You can do better. Steve, I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, and this kind of dovetails with what we're talking about. The next five callers who call in who have at least $500,000, we'll show them exactly how to do this, and we'll help them put together a complete plan for their retirement, and we'll do that on a complimentary basis, but it's only for the next five callers.
And the idea is you can convert your old 401k into an IRA that essentially becomes like a pension for you.
Exactly.
Bill Geiger, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you again, Steve.
A little bit later, we're going to go to the Chicago Half Marathon. That's coming up this weekend and talk to the brand manager of that. But right now, CNET, Bridget Carey is on a phone line. We usually talk to Ian Scherer, but Bridget filling in today. Bridget, you here with Bill and Wendy from time to time, I guess every week. Bridget, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me. Appreciate
it. So, you know, I know we have several stories to look at, and I'm looking at this Apple ID picture, which is fascinating to me, this article. There's another one about a lawsuit over Uber and driverless cars, and they're, you know, like 2-3 pages. And then there's the story about the new Teddy Ruxpin, and it's about 20 pages.
Well, it's a bit of a big project I was working on for a little while. Some like in-depth history for those 80s nerds out there.
You know, I really want to talk about the facial recognition on the iPhone, but maybe we should do Teddy first since that's a story you wrote. And I'm too old for him. I was graduating college in 85 when he was big, so I didn't get him the first time. But Teddy's come back a second time?
Yeah. Right now a new company is trying to bring him back by giving him big LCD screens for eyes that have crazy animations on them that keep changing all the time. He still has a little mouth that moves to the same, actually, old stories. I used to have the original bear when I grew up. And they're, you know, it's not necessarily a smart toy because they're like, you know what, toddlers, they don't need to worry about data and all that jazz.
Right, right.
Have something that talks. And as a mom of a toddler, I can tell you a lot of toddler toys now, they just, you know, don't do much. This is a rich product that has like long stories, but these were people who worked on Disney things beforehand. So the people who like built these stories, these music, they used to work at Disney. And in fact, the guy who invented the bear, I think that was an interesting thing about diving into the history. The guy who invented the bear used to work at Disneyland working on those animatronics.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, look, and he's sitting there looking at the tiki birds talk, and he's like, they actually work by big magnetic tapes. And he's like, how can I shrink that down into a toy? And that's why the original used a cassette tape. And he started bringing in all these people, and he kind of invented a way to do it small, but no one was giving him funding. Jim Henson came by, and he's like, that's cool, but I'm not going to invest in it right now. And Hasbro was like, nah, we'll do it in 5 years. And finally, this guy who used to work at Atari at the time, he lost his job because it was kind of changing over.
Sure.
Needed an investment. He goes, hey, I can make this. And in 6 months, he pumped, like, so much into this, marketing and really pushing it, putting it in stores with demos, that in 6 months they got it from a prototype to be the phenomenon it was.
It was a phenom, yeah. And so now they're hoping to this happened, and when my kids were toddlers and young kids, I found that toy companies were marketing to me the toys I grew up with out of nostalgia, thinking that I would buy them for my kids. And I totally fell for it a number of times, buying quote-unquote electronic games that I played with in the early 80s, for my son in 1998, which meant nothing to him. But I would buy those things. So I would imagine that's sort of what they're doing here. They're appealing to moms like you who grew up with Teddy Ruxpin, hoping you'll buy it for your kids.
That's exactly right. I walk in the toy aisle, it's like walking down my old bedroom. I mean, there's called Popples. I'm like, Popples are back? And then, yeah, Power Rangers, I'm like, that's back? I mean, it really is. In fact, obviously, Nintendo had, with their nostalgic old Super NES, that's hard to find with pre-orders. And then you got Polaroid even making cameras now where when you print it out, you have to wait for it to develop. That's the latest thing as of like a week ago.
Isn't that funny?
Everyone's all about the nostalgia.
Yeah, right. Polaroid is no longer the instant camera.
Right. But at the same time, they're like, hey, they actually made one that's not digital at all because people really want the retro.
All right, let's talk about the iPhone and this facial recognition. That was the big announcement. No home button. You can open the phone with your face. But if you're selling drugs on the corner, that might not be the right thing to do, or explain that for me.
Okay, so everyone's kind of wigging out a bit. If you think about it, well, if you can unlock a phone by just looking at it in 1 second, let's just stop someone from grabbing your phone and, putting it up to your face and boom, they have access, or even up a cop without a warrant. Like people always talked about how with a thumbprint, a cop could put your finger to it without a warrant and you unlock your phone. And there's a lot of talk about that. But now, isn't it easier if you just look at it? Well, there's some things to keep in mind. Security experts we talk to, they're kind of going over this saying it's not actually a new issue because courts have ruled police can compel people to unlock your device through Touch ID with a warrant. But
so,
passwords are different. A password is like your Fifth Amendment right to not say what your password is.
So that's interesting to me. So you're going to the same material. You're going to what's inside the phone, but you can be compelled with a search warrant to provide your thumbprint to open the phone, and you cannot be compelled to give them your 4-digit password.
Right.
What's the difference?
The judge in Virginia that kind of ruled this way, they were comparing it to giving police your thumbprint or a DNA sample. When you have a warrant, you have to give that up. So they're like, it's the same thing. But I would say if you are worried about this kind of stuff, use a passcode and not Face ID. That said, Apple, one of their executives, it leaked out. He was talking about there is a way, and we'll have to prove this when the phone comes out, that if you squeeze the buttons, like both the power button and the volume buttons at the same time, you'll temporarily disable it if you're worried about someone pressuring you. Maybe the phone's in your pocket or you're going to be sly about it. But in the heat of the moment, we're not always thinking about squeezing buttons to
right,
lock something.
Right.
And
the other thing is that
issue.
And you have to sort of engage with the phone, right? So if someone wants you to open it with your face and you just have your eyes closed, it probably won't work.
That's true. You could close your eyes. And then also, let's be honest here about the nature of people. If you're in a security line, you could just be pressured without a warrant. So some people just, even if there's no warrant, they don't feel like they want to cause trouble. They'll be like, okay, here you go. And without really fighting for their rights that they don't have to do that, it's very easy to be pressured with just one look or one fingerprint to unlock something.
Interesting
so
to me, yeah. That,
it's almost like something to think about.
That a digit password is more secure than a digital picture of your face when it comes to legal protection. I did not know that. Okay, well, maybe this guy who used to work at Uber need some legal protection as well. Tell me about this Waymo suit against Uber. Waymo makes driverless cars. They're suing Uber for a whopping $2.6 billion.
Yeah, so Waymo is a company that most people haven't heard of, but you have heard of Google, and Google owns Waymo. So this is basically Google's arm at doing self-driving cars. And the backstory here is that a Google employee allegedly stole files before leaving Google to start his own startup to make self-driving cars. And then Uber bought that startup and put that employee in charge of the self-driving car program. And he doesn't work at Uber anymore, but Google says, hey, those ideas he allegedly took, they could still be used in Uber. And so the latest is that Google's seeking $2.6 billion in damages for this alleged trade secret theft. And that's according to Reuters. That's the latest in this back and forth drama that doesn't look good for Uber.
The trial is supposed to start next month, right? I guess the hearing this week was to decide if they were still going to start in October. It still is, as far as you know.
Right. Yeah. So
is there any evidence?
One of these long things we've heard for a while, but yeah, it's drawn out a bit.
So this is one of those things where they probably haven't suffered $2.6 billion in damages yet, but they're going to argue that they could eventually, right? Is that kind of their point?
Right, exactly. This is a hot new area where all the tech companies are trying to get in on. I mean, you even hear of stories of Apple cooking up something,
right. Maybe.
Everyone's trying to figure out, how to make it work. Tesla and others, and so they're saying that there's so much on the line here.
I was golfing actually with a guy from Pittsburgh last week, and he was talking about how in Pittsburgh. Is it Google? One of the companies is actually using Pittsburgh as a testing ground for driverless cars.
I want to say it's either Uber or Lyft, but yeah, these companies do have their cars on the road in certain cities already.
How far are we away from them being in every city?
The cities tend to be a little iffy about letting them. There's a lot of rules, like there still has to be a person behind the wheel.
Right.
Sitting there, these cars, like Google invented a car that doesn't even have a steering wheel. That said, it's only on their campus because most places still want the gas pedals and the steering wheel there to make it legal on the road.
There are a couple of aldermen here in Chicago who actually introduced an ordinance that would ban driverless cars. And that's because their ordinance to ban electricity apparently failed. So they're going to continue to fight progress anywhere they can.
It's not just about the creepy feeling, oh my gosh, things are driving without you. If you think about how bad we are as distracted drivers as it is, people looking at their phones on Snapchat or whatever, it doesn't hurt to have a few more sensors to stop you from being stupid.
Bridget Carey from CNET, great to talk to you. I appreciate you filling in today.
Yeah, good to talk to you too. Thanks.
I don't know. I saw a guy running by the window earlier today. It seems awfully hot. We're in the 90s here. In mid to late September, but the Chicago Half Marathon coming up this weekend. The brand manager for the run, Dan Lakin, is on a phone line. Dan, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon to you.
All right, so are you a runner?
I am a runner.
Are you running in the half marathon?
I'm not. We're on the production side of things this weekend, so I am not running this weekend, but we're preparing for 12,000 runners.
That's amazing. All right, so you're the brand manager of all this. Tell me what goes into creating or maintaining a brand for a run involving 12,000 people.
It all starts out with recruiting our runners and getting them to train. With Lifetime, we have run locations throughout the Chicago area. We have about 9 different locations. But creating an experience is what we look for when we're creating a brand. The look and feel is what we live by. And our experience when our runners come to the race, from the moment we have to shuttle runners to our race, to the moment they get on to one of our race shuttles, to when they leave the race on race day, we think about that experience in every little touch point along the way.
How do you measure success? I mean, do you measure success in return customers, or what is it you look for?
A few things. In today's day and age, we also measure our success based on social media. How many people are sharing their experience on social media? We look at photos, the use of our hashtag, people checking into the race, as well as post-race surveys and our retention and people coming back year over year.
What have you found that works the best when it comes to retention?
One of the best things is our race medal and our race swag. So we pay attention to what we give the athlete for accomplishing running 13.1 miles. So we're known for having a 6-inch huge finisher medal when people finish. We put a lot of attention to detail into that touch point item for them, as well as that participant shirt for them to take home. Make sure it's a good quality fabric, good material, something they're going to be proud of when they finish.
That's interesting. And, you know, because you might think of, I'm going to go get a cool shirt, but there's a little more emphasis there than we thought. Yeah, I'm going to do this because I get a cool shirt.
Right. And we look into the design, just even the design for our medal and our shirt. We start that as soon as the current race, this year's race is over. We'll spend about a 2 to 3 month process in choosing a design and getting it just right.
What do you do then? Because if you have a medal this year and you had a medal last year and you had a medal the year before, what is it that you look at for next year that might make it different or that the research would have to be different?
Sure. So we can't do the same medal year after year. People like to have, you know, something unique. So, you know, for this year's race, we made sure that it includes imagery from Chicago, as well as the integrating sort of a water effect to it. So we integrate Lake Michigan with it. And as well as if people did our spring race and they're doing this race, they're going to receive an extra medal so that they will all attach together to form 3 medals.
Cool.
And it includes a spinning Ferris wheel to represent Navy Pier.
You do go for the swag, don't you?
Oh, we do. We put a lot of detail into it. Last year's our medal spun to celebrate our 20th year. We put a lot of thought behind it.
All right. So the benefit, obviously, for you is that people come in, they run, they return, they spread the news about the city. I'm interested in that, about the role of the half marathon as an ambassador, sort of an external ambassador. I know all 50 states will be represented, 41 countries will be here, and it matters, right? Their experience here matters because they're going to go home and talk about that.
Exactly, and that's really important to us. Only about 40% of our participants actually live in Chicago. So what people go back home and talk about and say to their friends, their family, they post on social media about their experience and their trip here in Chicago, that matters to us when we're talking about 60% of our audience then coming from outside of Chicago. As you said, it's an international race with 41 countries represented. It's important for us to be good ambassadors of the city. It's a great city, world-class, and we like to show that off, especially part of that element is you get a unique experience in running in Lakeshore Drive. We can close it down completely to traffic from 31st Street to 67th Street. So providing that unique experience for our participants matters, as well as how Chicago plays host.
Going to be hot?
It's going to be a little warm. Our race day temperature, it looks like it's going to start out in the low 70s. But it is going to heat up as soon as the sun comes up over Lake Michigan.
Dan Lakin, the Run Brand Manager for the Chicago Half Marathon. Hey, have a great day on Sunday. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you for having us.